Welcome to the Pan Am Podcast, brought to you by the Pan Am Museum in Garden City, New York. This podcast and our museum are dedicated to celebrating the legacy of the world's most iconic airline, Pan American World Airways. My name is Tom Betty, and I'm the host of this program. Thank you for joining us. The Pan Am Museum Foundation is a nonprofit organization. Please visit our website for more information at thepanammuseum.org. Again, our website is thepanammuseum.org. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. If you are using Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving a review. It will help others discover this program. This podcast is sponsored by the generous personal support of Mr. Adam Aaron, the CEO and chairman of AMC Theaters. He is also president of our sister organization, the Pan Am Historical Foundation. If you're not familiar with Pan Am, welcome. We are honored to have you here and for you to learn about what we're all about. If you already know of Pan Am, worked for or flown on the airline, or just love our history, it's good to be with you again. So with that, let's get this episode in the air, so to speak. Welcome aboard your Pan American Jet Clipper.
Now, when you fly the flag, you can fly the future. British Airways Concorde, the first supersonic passenger airliner to fly you at more than twice the speed of sound. Concorde has crossed the Atlantic in 3.5 hours. And now she will fly you to Bahrain, faster than ever before. It's all part of taking more care of you, giving you what you need, first, best, and fastest. Fly the future. Fly the flag with British Airways.
You just heard a commercial from British Airways in 1976. In this episode, we welcome back to the program Captain Mike Bannister, the chief pilot of British Airways Concorde Fleet from 1995 to 2003. He is also the author of a recently published book titled Concorde. The book is available through your favorite bookstore or online retailer. There is a link in the episode description to purchase this book. Also coming out to great fanfare in 2023 was a special Lego set of the Concorde designed to be built by adults. This special detailed replica from Lego of the world's most famous supersonic commercial passenger airplane gives builders an immersive project that takes creativity to new heights. There is also a link in the episode description to order your own Lego Concorde set. To learn more about supersonic transports, or SSTs for short, listen to episode 7 of this program titled Supersonic Transports, an Angry JFK, and Flying the Line after this installment. In that episode, we explored the race for the first passenger supersonic aircraft between a British and French partnership, the United States, and the Soviet Union. This episode is also a direct follow-up to episode 19, titled Concorde, where we explore the fascinating history of Concorde and interview three special guests. Jetliner Cabins author Jennifer Coutts Clay, who was Pan Am's general manager for product design and development, and before that worked on the Concorde project for British Airways. John Lampel, a veteran executive of British Airways who worked for the Concorde program the entire 27 years of passenger service and a total of 41 years for BA. And of course, Captain Bannister was interviewed in that episode. Again, if you haven't heard episode 19 already, we encourage you to listen after this installment. Captain Mike Bannister joined BOAC, British Airways' predecessor, in 1969 as a pilot and flight navigator on the Vickers VC-10 fleet. He joined the Concorde flight crew in 1977, becoming the fleet's youngest pilot. In 1995, he became the chief pilot of British Airways' Concorde program until the retirement of the aircraft in 2003. Captain Bannister accumulated around 9,600 Concorde flight hours, with almost 7,000 of which were supersonic. Before our interview with Captain Mike Bannister, let's listen to a 6-minute clip on the incredible history of Concorde from British Airways and luxury watchmaker Bremont. In 2018, the two companies joined forces for a special and exclusive timepiece. Metal from a Concorde known as Alpha Bravo was used by Bremont to incorporate into only 500 limited edition watches. The aircraft was registered in 1974 and was the third Concorde to join the British Airways fleet. Aluminum taken from the plane was incorporated into a decorated ring visible through the case back. This ring also features a description of the aircraft's number and registration, years of active service, number of supersonic flights, as well as the aircraft's top speed. Let's take a listen and then on to our interview with Captain Mike Bannister.
Over 2.5 million passengers enjoyed supersonic flight on Concorde, slicing through the stratosphere, 11 miles above the Earth's surface and at over twice the speed of sound, witnessing the curvature of the Earth below and the deep blue of space above. Rarely does a machine garner such affection, but during her 27-year service, Concorde secured a place in people's hearts. A design marvel, a message from tomorrow. Nothing in the world of aviation has rivaled her since. The Bremont supersonic chronometer marks the 50th birthday of this very sublime flying machine, an icon of British engineering. By 1962, Great Britain and France signed a treaty to develop a supersonic airliner. The result was Concorde. Concorde first flew in 1969. Her elegant design was worlds apart from the subsonic airliner fleet. Her delta wing with its swept-back curve was sculpted from one solid piece of aluminium. Over 5,000 hours of wind tunnel testing ensured the wing could generate lift at both low and supersonic speeds. Mach 2.2 was to be the safe speed her aluminium structure could withstand. At these speeds, her skin temperature would already reach over 90 degrees Celsius, and her airframe would stretch up to 11 inches.
In 1962, when the Concorde was first conceived, the world had not seen a supersonic airliner. The only aircraft capable of Mach 2.2 were jet fighters, one-seater, two-seaters. They had very limited range, and they certainly couldn't take 100 people in comfort across the Atlantic. It really was an engineering marvel. Nobody had seen anything like this before, but even more remarkably, nobody has seen anything like this since.
Her 24-foot-long nose cone was distinctive. Shaped like a bullet, it was designed to droop for landings and takeoff, enabling the pilots to see the runway. At high speeds, the nose was raised and a reinforced tinted visor slid up to protect the cockpit at supersonic speeds. Concorde's design was ahead of its time. She was drawn up on blueprints and early wing designs were tested using paper aeroplanes. Her prototype airframes underwent more testing than any subsonic airliner ever had. When Concorde was built, no engine was capable of accepting airflow at supersonic speeds.
One of the challenges was to produce an engine that would give us enough power to take off and fly supersonically. They chose the Olympus engine that had been developed for other aircraft, but we vastly developed it for Concorde. It produced a lot more power.
The roar of Concorde's engines became a familiar sound at London's Heathrow Airport. On the takeoff roll, the powerful thrust of her four Rolls-Royce Olympus turbojets pushed passengers back into their seats. Each engine supplied 38,000 pounds of thrust with afterburner, a feature usually found on military jets.
For a pilot who loves flying airplanes, it was the ultimate. The real satisfaction right down to the very bones of a pilot to fly this wonderful airplane. Although it's so obviously beautiful, I think people really understand that it was a sophisticated piece of engineering. Everything was precision made. So much of it was international, but so much of it was British. And everybody feels a sense of pride that we actually did this. The rest of the world couldn't, but it was done by those that brought Concorde to life.
Concorde's aerodynamic design gave her an instantly recognizable silhouette. It is this iconic silhouette, which has been incorporated into the beautiful mechanical movement of the Bremont supersonic.
To mark the 50th anniversary of the first flight of Concorde, Bremont's creating the Bremont Supersonic, which is a limited edition watch, incorporating parts of Golf Alpha Bravo, the Concorde still owned by British Airways, which resides at Heathrow. This is our first manual wire movement that Bremont has ever produced. It's an 8-day parareserve, which incorporates a parareserve indicator within the dial. So it's a pleasure to be working with British Airways on this project as they celebrate their centenary and, importantly, 50 years of Concorde.
Concorde's maximum operating ceiling was 60,000 feet. Any military pilot at similar altitudes would be wearing a spacesuit and breathing oxygen. Concorde passengers, however, were wearing shirt sleeves and drinking champagne. When she was finally withdrawn from service in 2003, hundreds of thousands turned out to wish her a fond farewell. While she undoubtedly saved her passengers' time, there were many who wished the flight lasted longer.
Thank you for coming on the program, sir.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Tom.
So let's talk about a golfing story on the Concorde.
Yeah, Concorde was used for a whole bunch of special flights or charter flights in addition to its scheduled program. These special flights would range from a quick trip round the bay where you'd take off at one airfield and an hour and 40 minutes later land back at it, having gone up to 60,000 feet and twice the speed of sound, all the way to a round-the-world air cruise where you'd be going from five-star hotel to five-star hotel, traveling on Concorde for 23 days. It was also used for sporting events and, in particular, carrying the U.S. Golfers around the world, particularly between the U.K. and the U.S.A. It was also used for the European Ryder Cup team in 1999, when they flew over to compete against the U.S.A. team. They took a flight to Boston, a special charter flight, which in itself was unusual. We rarely went there. And during the flight, Jose Maria Lethabal decided he'd have a go at breaking the world record for the longest putt. So he figured if he could putt a golf ball from the front of Concorde to the back, then during the time that the putt is rolling, the airplane will have traveled a long way at twice the speed of sound. And that's exactly what he did. So he putted from the front all the way to the back, and it went into the cup. The ball was moving for an amazing 26 seconds. And in that time, it traveled 9.2 miles, a brand new record. Ironically, beating the American Fred Fraxon's record from 1997, where he did something similar, but that was only 8.5 miles. The European managed to beat it.
That's a great story. Let's go back to 2003, the final arrival at Heathrow of the Concorde. I understand that you landed in Heathrow. You and your co-pilot opened your windows and flew the Union Jack out of the window. But then something unexpected happened.
Yeah, we were quite keen on flying the flags out of the windows. When we left New York, we had a Union flag flying out of one side and the Stars and Stripes out of the other, because we'd wanted to make the last flight a real celebration of the 27 years of successful supersonic flight for Concorde and British Airways. And also, the airport at Kennedy was very keen to give us a wonderful send-off. And to that extent, the airport fire service has arranged a water arch for us to taxi under, a red, white, and blue water arch. It was great. And we did that. It was very spectacular, and there were lots of wonderful photographs taken. Then off we go, set off for London. And I guess whilst we were in flight, the message had got across to Heathrow about what the New York fire service had done. So I got a message saying that the Heathrow Fire Service had decided to do something similar, that we would go under a water arch on arrival as well. Great, we can do that. So we landed and we were taxiing in and we're approaching the water arch. I've done this once or twice, so I know what the routine is. I've got the Union flag out of the window and it's out of the window. Literally, you just open the window. So the routine is flag in, close window, taxi under water arch, open window, flag out. Dead easy. So we approach the water arch, right, flag in, close window. Oh, no, window jammed.
Oh, no.
And we taxied under the water arch with the window wide open. And literally a fire hose amount of water came in straight into the flight deck window on the left-hand side where I sit. And I got absolutely drenched. It's October the 24th. It's quite chilly. And so when we parked up and cleared customs, the first thing I had to do was to go off to the media center, which was a temporary structure, three stories high, mark you, with all the various media from around the world. And the first interview I had to do was with Richard Quest from CNN, who I knew quite well because I'd done a number of things with him before. I knew him well enough so that when I walked up towards him, squashing across the floor with water coming out of my shoes and my trousers and my uniform jacket absolutely soaked, he could not stop laughing. He was absolutely guffawing, so much so that we had to delay the interview while I just stood there and literally dripped on the floor.
And I don't think that shone through on TV because I didn't see that at all when I watched it on TV.
Such are the benefits of having a dark blue uniform, I guess. And a British stiff upper lip, maybe.
That's a great story. That's a great story. How about celebrities and memorable passengers on your flights?
We've had lots and lots of celebrities. Everybody perceives that celebrities made up a huge amount of the customers that traveled with Concorde. Actually, they didn't. 80% of the people were business people, but celebrities were notable. And apart from many, many members of the UK royal family, we also carried many politicians. We carried film stars, TV stars, a lot of whom wanted to travel incognito. And of course, what British Airways on Concorde offered was a certain level of discretion. Some not quite so incognito. Elizabeth Taylor was a famous one, and a particular flight back from New York to London was one of those days when we had very strong tailwinds, the jet stream. And this is in the early days when there was not a lot known about the jet stream. It's a very narrow tube of high-velocity winds that can sit over the Atlantic at about 50 to 55,000 feet. And its position varies. It goes north and south, and we now know that it drags weather systems with it. But in those days, we knew that it was around, and if we could find it and sit in it, we'd get some really strong tailwinds, 150, sometimes almost 200 miles an hour, speeding us up as we crossed the Atlantic. So it was a great tool for record crossing attempts. And this particular day was one of those days, and the circumstances were right. So I got onto the public address system and told the customers what we were doing. Of course, I'd told the cabin crew before that we were trying to cross the Atlantic in well less than 3 hours, the record at the time being 2 hours and 54 minutes. And we were going really well until about two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic. The jet stream swung away from our track and we dropped out of it. And it was clear, whilst we were going to beat 3 hours, we weren't going to beat the record. So I got on the public address system and told the customers what was happening and that we weren't going to beat the record, but it was still going to be a very rapid crossing, and thought nothing more of it until about 2 or 3 minutes later, the chief stewardess came up and said, "Mike, just got a message here from Elizabeth Taylor." I said, "Oh, yeah." She said, "If you're not going to beat the record, could you please slow down because she takes 45 minutes to put her makeup on?" Needless to say, we always accommodate our customers' requests, so we did slow down, but not a huge amount.
I heard a story about an SR-71 Blackbird and Concorde from an air traffic controller story, that they needed 5,000 feet vertical separation. And they called the SR-71 Blackbird and said, you know, what is your altitude? And they said above 60,000 feet. And the air traffic controller said, "I need to know your exact altitude because I have a Concorde that is crossing your path." And the SR-71 Blackbird responded saying, "Well, what is their altitude?" And they said 59,000 feet, and we need 4,000 feet vertical separation. Then they responded with a chuckle and said, "We're well above that," because at that time it was classified on how high the SR-71 Blackbird could go. Was that one of your flights by chance?
Not that particular one, but I have flown at the same sort of time as a Blackbird. One of the special flights we did was to go out to Abbotsford for the air show there. It was a trip out to Vancouver, and we did some flights around Vancouver and again, these special short special flights taking off from Vancouver, landing back. And we sold those tickets to fund the whole trip and to enable us to go to the Abbotsford Air Show. And the Blackbird was displaying there as well. And we got to know the crew quite well. Obviously, there was no arrangement for us to fly together, and the air show was organized so that two main exhibits like ours were not contrasting against each other. We were flying at different times. But we went off on and flew, and then we landed and they flew. And that was kind of happened for two or three days. And the third or fourth day, we were doing a flight, again, a quick flight out of Vancouver, back into Vancouver before the air show. And whilst we were out, we were up at about 58, 59,000 feet. A flight engineer pointed out something up above us, way, way above us, that was contrailing. And we thought, well, that's got to be the Blackbird, hasn't it? I mean, we were up at 59,000 feet, so it's got to be the Blackbird. Amazing. We looked up, and the contrail out of it was a little bit unusual in that it was sort of pulsing. It wasn't a steady flow contrail. It was kind of a beat to it. Anyway, didn't think much more about that till we landed, and we went over and had a cup of tea and then wandered over to chat to the SR-71 crew, only to discover they had a technical unserviceability and hadn't flown that day. So when we told them what we'd seen and said, you know, well, it must have been another Blackbird, they said, well, we're not supposed to tell you that there are no other Blackbirds in the area. And in hindsight, we think we saw something new and unusual, and the pulse contrail coming out of the back of it would be very similar to that would be made by a pulse jet. And there's been a lot of speculation since those days about whether the US had special projects and aircraft that have remained secret until this day. And in the back of my mind, I kind of think that maybe that particular day we saw one of those. Whether we did or not, I don't know, but it was very interesting. When we told the Blackbird crew, they were just as interested as we were.
Fascinating. Question for you. So after 2003, after the Concorde was retired, did you continue flying? If so, how was the transition to subsonic aircraft?
By the time that Concorde retired in 2003, I was also the general manager for all British Airways short-haul and medium-haul aircraft. So the 737, 757, 767, the Airbus family, as well as Concorde. And so when Concorde had stopped, I figured I'd go fly one of my short-haul airplanes, probably an Airbus. And I was kind of making plans to do that when I got a call from the boss who said, Mike, I'd like you to look after Gatwick as well. So British Airways had a main operation at Gatwick. And the idea was that I would look after the Heathrow operation 3 days a week and the Gatwick operation 3 days a week, which if you work out 6 days a week, I only get a day a week off. But hey-ho. He said to me, and before you ask, there's no more money. So I thought, why am I doing this? Well, the main reason I did it was going to be good fun and a new challenge and a new operating environment. So, yeah, why not? So I swapped flying Concorde for driving my car around the motorways between Heathrow and London. And that was interesting, but it wasn't like the real thing. So I carried on flying small airplanes. I'd actually got quite a long history in general aviation. I had run an air taxi company in the 80s and 90s. I'd flown for the UK Army parachute team, the Red Devils. So I'd got a lot of general aviation experience. So I carried on doing some of that. And our daughter, Amy, was getting older and older and getting more and more interested in aviation. So I'd take her along with me. Fast forward 10 years and Amy graduates as a commercial pilot. And she now flies for a major airline in the UK. And now she takes me flying. And so I jump into small airplanes, and she's the pilot in command, and I'm the co-pilot, and we go off and toodle and enjoy ourselves. So, yeah, I still fly to this day, and I also fly the Concorde simulator, which is at Brooklands. It was the very simulator that I and all my colleagues learned to fly on and did our regular checks on. It was moved to Brooklands in a terrible state because it had been completely surrounded at Filton at Bristol, where it was housed. It had to be cut out of the cell. But the team at Brooklands put it back together, and now it flies just as well as it ever did. It's actually a real Concorde flight deck, not made to look like one. It really is one. And members of the public come and fly with me or with my colleagues, and we've had all sorts of people, from an 85-year-old lady who had never flown. I don't mean never piloted. She had never flown, all the way through to a pilot coming all the way from Boeing in Seattle just to fly the Concorde simulator. So, yeah, I still get the buzz and still get the enjoyment of flying and still get the expectation of looking forward to doing just that.
Let's talk about your daughter for a second. So you have an aviation legacy that you left. How does that make you feel?
Oh, absolutely delighted. Most important, of course, is that she is happy and she's doing what she wants to do. And my wife and I never actively encouraged her to take up being a pilot or being in aviation, although both of we were. But obviously, by osmosis, it kind of gets its way into the system. And she's very much her own person. She doesn't want to be in her parents' shadow. She wants to follow in her parents' footsteps until she makes her own path. And that's great. And I absolutely love it. And she is very happy and she's really enjoying it. And we occasionally go on flights where she's the pilot. And of course, needless to say, being a very proud parents, we just sit there smiling all the way with our chests puffed out, thinking that's our daughter. It's great. I love it.
That's great. Let's talk about Pan Am. What is your opinion of Pan American World Airways and the what if Pan Am did not cancel their Concorde order? What would you speculate about what would have happened?
Pan Am was a great airline and one that we in British Airways and before that the OAC highly respected. Of course, they were competitors on many routes around the world, but on other routes they were complementary. We would occasionally meet up with their crews and socialize with them so that on the social level we'd get in. Clearly on a competitive level, each was trying to always be a little better than the other, but it was a friendly competitiveness and one underscored by much mutual admiration and appreciation for the technical nature of their operation. I mean, Pan American technically were a very good airline, as were BOAC and British Airways. So there was an aviation kinship. It was terribly sad when the accident in Lockerbie came about, and that was partially to bring about the downfall of Pan American, something I was very, very sad about because I had personal friends who were flying for Pan American at the time. But before that, of course, Pan American was one of the companies that had expressed a serious interest in acquiring Concorde. At one point during its project development in the very early 70s, there were over 230 aircraft orders and options placed for Concorde by airlines around the world, of which Pan American was one. And it looked at that stage that the Concorde program was going to be very successful worldwide. But then two fundamental things happened. First of all, there was a major fuel crisis and a major fuel price hike in 1973-74, where the price of fuel doubled practically overnight and the price of crude oil went up. And airlines were faced with a choice. Well, you know, what do we do? Do we use the fuel that we can now afford to buy, which is probably about half of what we could afford to buy before? Do we use that to fly this supersonic airliner with 100 passengers on board? Or do we use it to fly this brand new Boeing 747 with upwards of 400 passengers on board? Ironically, crossing the Atlantic with a full Concorde burned marginally less than a full 747, but earned quite a bit more money for the company. But they were thinking ahead and thinking about the future and generating and maintaining strong customer bases. So it's more or less a no-brainer that keeping 100 passengers happy was not as desirable as keeping 400 passengers happy. So Pan American and all of the other airlines elected to cancel their Concorde orders. When I say all, I do mean all, including British Airways and Air France. But at the time, those two airlines were owned by their respective governments, their respective taxpayers, who had poured lots of money into the design and development of Concorde and who told British Airways and Air France that they were going to operate it. Both British Airways and Air France at the time were not keen on that idea. They thought they'd lose money and they were not keen on having to support the ongoing development of the airplane and support the infrastructure. So they spoke to the governments and struck a deal whereby the UK government and the French government would underwrite any losses that British Airways or Air France made. Downside of that was that if those two airlines made profits out of Concorde, the governments wanted 90% of the profit, which is not an unreasonable deal if you're underwriting all the losses. That was okay for a while, but British Airways went to the UK government in 1984 and said, we can't really work with this. There's no incentive to make any money. How about we pay for all of the costs, we stand all the losses, but keep all the profit? It was a lot more complicated than that, but fundamentally that was the thing. And that's what happened. And from that point forward, Concorde had the ability to become a very profitable airline. But of course, by this stage, there were only two airlines in the world flying supersonic passenger transports, which meant it was very, very much a niche and exclusive market. And we could charge really high prices because there was very little competition. It was just London, New York, and one or two other scheduled destinations, or Paris, New York. And what we did was decide that the first thing we needed to do was to find out how much flexibility there was in the pricing. So we asked our regular customers how much they thought they paid for a Concorde ticket. Well, of course, the chief exec and the chief financial officer of big companies don't buy their own tickets. Their PAs do it for them. So these individuals didn't really know, so they guessed. And they guessed a figure about 30 to 40% higher than what they were actually paying. So if they thought they were paying 40% more than they really were paying, if we put the price up by 20% and told them it's 20% less than they think they're paying, you know, all around a win. And that's what we did. And so we then were making lots of profit out of Concorde, which we probably would not have been so successful in making if lots of other airlines, including Pan American, had had it. The pilot in me, of course, would much rather have seen a worldwide fleet of Concordes than the 14 that actually came into service. But the commercial person in me said that, ironically, British Airways and Air France benefited significantly from the fact that all of the other airlines pulled out. And at Brooklands Museum, where I'm vice chair of trustees, we actually have a cabinet that has 13 models in it with the liveries of 13 different airlines, not including Air France and British Airways, one of which was Pan American. Sadly, to report that of those 13, seven of those airlines are no longer with us. So Pan American wasn't the only one that failed. But yeah, it would have been great to see a Concorde flying with Pan Am on the fin.
We are going to take a quick break with a 2023 commercial from Lego announcing the new Concorde set.
Elegance. Speed. Grace. There are moments in time when it seems that anything is possible. Presenting an icon of supersonic travel. A marvel of engineering. Reimagined in Lego bricks. The Concorde crossed the sound barrier as it crossed the Atlantic in 3.5 hours. Less time than it will take to build and enjoy this majestic wonder of aviation. The new Lego Concorde. Adults, welcome aboard.
Welcome back to our interview with British Airways Captain Mike Bannister, author of the book Concorde, now available at bookstores worldwide. Looking at Pan Am history, like in the 1960s, Pan Am viewed supersonic aircraft as the future. The 747 was designed to be first for passengers, but then once the supersonic fleet started becoming a reality, they were going to convert it to cargo. So the 747 was designed for passengers and cargo with the explicit goal of transferring everything to supersonic fleet in the next, you know, 25 years from the 1960s. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, but it's certainly fascinating to hypothesize.
Yeah, and of course, it's kind of in people's minds now in that the next generation supersonic aircraft, and my glass is always half full. I think there will be one. I happen to think that Boom Overture is a very strong contender. And the concept is that it will get into service, it will provide a supersonic service at an attainable price, and it will start taking some of the premium traffic from subsonic aircraft. So that concept of the premiums flying supersonic and the non-premiums flying subsonic may well yet come to pass to a certain extent, certainly on the high-density routes where there is a lot of business traffic. Clearly, it doesn't make sense to pay a huge amount more to travel twice as fast if you're going on holiday. It might be a very enjoyable part of your holiday experience, but If you rationalize the cost, maybe that's not the way to go. But certainly for a business person, time is very much money. And even in these days of remote conferencing and video conferencing and all talking to each other across the world by computers, the real import of face-to-face communication and face-to-face business is still there. I recall once years ago, this was past the Gulf War when a lot of people had stopped flying, talking to a particular regular Concorde customer who was back flying with us, having had a period of working remotely because nobody was flying post the Gulf War. And I actually said to him, you know, you're back flying, which is great. We love it. But surely, you know, video conferencing enables you to do things without having to travel. And he said, well, yeah, for the low level stuff, we can do that. I'm going to New York potentially to seal a multi-billion dollar deal. He said, I want to be there. I want to look the other parties in the eyes. And before I sign, I want to see whether the perspiration breaks out on the other guy's forehead. And I want to see who's pulling the strings. And I can do that by going to New York and back in a day. He said, it's a no-brainer. You know, the Concorde cost is absolutely nothing compared to the cost of getting this deal wrong. So I think people will continue to aspire to travel quickly. And I'm a great believer that that is the destiny of air travel. And it always has been. The human race has always wanted to travel faster.
How does it make you feel that you were part of the next generation of aviation aircraft?
I'm very proud of that. And I'm very honored and privileged to have been part. You know, the 7-year-old boy who wanted to be a pilot had dreams of becoming a commercial pilot. And as those came towards fruition, increased dreams to be a Concorde pilot. And that all came to pass. And I was lucky enough to have two bites of the cherry, two times on Concorde, one as a co-pilot instructor, and then came back as chief pilot. And, you know, when you think about the vision that a 7-year-old kid would have, if you told that 7-year-old kid that one day you'll end up not only as a Concorde pilot, but as the chief pilot responsible for the flight operations of the entire fleet, and you will fly the airplane for 22 years, and you will get more Concorde flight time than anybody else in the world, and that you'll have more supersonic flight hours than practically any other air force in the world, he wouldn't have believed you. But he'd have been very happy little lad, thinking it was at all possible, just like I'm a very happy little old man thinking I've been fortunate enough to be part of it. And hopefully the legacy that Concorde has left, not my legacy, but the legacy that Concorde has left, is still in the forefront of lots of people's mind. It is quite amazing that now, as we talk, there is not a child in the world that has seen a Concorde fly, because it's over 18 years since Concorde last flew. So there's not a child in the world that's seen a Concorde fly, and yet I know, particularly my experiences at the museums around the world that have Concorde exhibits, that children are absolutely fascinated by the airplane. They're fascinated by its shape, they're fascinated by its style, and fascinated by what it could do. So if we can continue to inspire children and young people about the art of the possible, anything can be done.
I have a couple young people that work in my office. You know, at lunch the other day, I was talking about how, you know, I was talking to you. They said, well, what is a Concorde? And I said, you don't know what a Concorde is? And they're like, no. And instead of being like, oh my God, how could you not know? You know, it's an opportunity to educate. So I pulled out my phone and I showed them a picture, and they said, that's a plane? And I said, yeah, let me show you this video. And they're like, that is the most beautiful looking plane I've ever seen. So now they're learning about Concorde because the image is so striking.
Yeah, the psychologists tell us that one of the reasons for that is it appeals to both sides of the brain. It appeals to the left side and the right side. It appeals to the artistic side and the technical side. People realize it is beautiful, and they also appreciate what it could do. And so, you know, it has always been one of those aircraft that everybody always looked up at when it flew over. And from the beginning of the Concorde project all the way until the very last day, people would look up, even those that lived near to Heathrow or near to Kennedy, who would see it regularly, they'd still stop and still look up as it flew over.
I talked to my dad the day that we chatted, and I said, you're not going to believe what happened to me today. And he said, well, what happened? And I said, well, I was 6 years old, and he took me to the Cleveland Air Show, and we saw the Concorde. he's like, oh yeah, you were totally enamored by that plane. And I said, well, I just talked to the guy that was flying that plane that day in Cleveland. And he's like, wow, that is like fate.
Well, it is kind of, isn't it? It is fate, yeah. 2.5 million people flew on Concorde with British Airways. So it's not that unusual for me to encounter people that have flown with BA on Concorde and quite often with me on Concorde. But what I find amazing is still the general level of interest about Concorde amongst the aviation population, the technical population, and the non-aviation, non-technical population. People are still fascinated. I expected there still to be an interest because it was unique and it's very special. So you kind of expect there to be a lingering interest. But the level of the interest is still far more than I ever anticipated. And it still amazes me to this day how many people are still fascinated by this wonderful aircraft so many years after it last flew.
When I interview Pan Am pilots, I ask them to do something for me. Sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't, but it's kind of a cool little thing. Can you, as Captain Bannister on a Concorde, can you give us some cabin announcements as if you were on the plane? I know that the Concorde program, you had very specific announcements at specific times during the flight.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Actually, we didn't have specific announcements at specific times in the flight. Nobody predicated that you will say this then. But it was kind of evolved by some form of magic that there were certain junctions within the flight that you really wanted to talk to the passengers and let them know what was going to happen. So you'd got people on board, some of whom had flown literally hundreds of times on Concorde, some who were flying for the first and probably the only time on Concorde. So you had to find a way of talking with the customers that entertained them, fascinated the people on there for the first time, but at the same time didn't bore to death those that had heard something similar. So there was no predicated way of doing it. We all did our own thing. We all said what we felt was appropriate. And we all developed our own personal routines. We didn't have a script, but we did talk quite often on the PA. When I say quite often, maybe 3-4 announcements during flight. So that's sort of kind of once every 45 minutes-ish. One of the reasons, of course, for that was there was no in-flight movie. You didn't need an in-flight movie system on Concorde, and there was very high quality in-seat sound, but no movie because by the time you'd got on board and you'd had an absolutely fantastic lunch or breakfast occasionally, or occasionally dinner, you'd be three quarters of the way there. So there wasn't really time for a movie. So it was really all about keeping your customers informed. And one of the key things for me was just before we went through the sound barrier. That was the essence of Concorde. You are going to fly faster than sound. And a lot of people had the perception that was born out of some of the post-war black and white movies, that flying through the sound barrier was very dangerous, that the airplane would vibrate and shake, and that it was very difficult to do, and that the pilots who did it were really heroes and all that stuff. Well, of course, post-war, that was actually true. And the airplanes did shake, and the people that did it were heroes. But the fantastic designers that put Concorde together had made it so that the passage literally through the sound barrier was totally sensation-free, which is one of the reasons we put indicators in the cabin to tell the passengers what speed we were at and what height we were at. And so what we would do is we ran up towards the point where we're going to accelerate to supersonic speed would be to come on the public address and say something along the lines of, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is your captain speaking, Mike Bannister from the flight deck. We're now approaching the point where we're going to accelerate to supersonic speeds. We're currently traveling at Mach 0.95, 95% of the speed of sound, some 150 to 158 miles an hour faster than an ordinary subsonic jet. But the fun bit comes now because we're going to put our engines up to full power and switch on the reheats, the afterburners that we use for takeoff. This time, we're going to switch the reheats on in pairs. Indeed, you might feel two slight nudges of acceleration as they come in, which is absolutely the only sensation of going through the sound barrier. Apart from the two nudges of acceleration, all you'll see is the indicator in front of you clicking up until we get to Mach 1.00, the speed of sound. Then we'll continue climbing and accelerating through the speed of sound until we reach Mach 1.7. And at that stage, Concorde's engines have become so efficient that we can switch the reheats off. And Concorde can do something that no other aircraft in the world can do, which is to climb and accelerate at the same time from Mach 1.7 to Mach 2 with just full power without the need for reheats and afterburners. And so then I'd go on to actually give them a countdown to switching the reheats on, and the nudge that they felt in the back was really quite noticeable. Not uncomfortable, but certainly something that you could feel. And that's why we switched the reheats on in pairs, because if we switch all four reheats on together, the nudge would be that much harder, and there'd be a distinct possibility of spilling the customer's drinks, and you never want to do that.
That's fascinating. Anything you'd like to add about Concorde?
There's another couple of people that I met that might be of interest.
Sure.
So I'm a great ballet fan, and I fortunately had the opportunity once to have Rudolf Nureyev flying as a customer. This is in the days before 9/11, in the days when we could invite people onto the flight deck, and it wasn't unusual for us to invite somebody on the flight deck during the flight, quite a few people usually, and occasionally somebody on the flight deck for the takeoff and landing. And on this occasion, because I'm a ballet fan, we invited Rudolf Nureyev up for the takeoff and for the landing. And on the crossing, chatting to him, I had been to see him dance at Covent Garden. I was very, very lucky because I turned up. I just sort of out of the blue decided I'd go to the ballet at Covent Garden in London. And I just literally rocked up there at the box office and said, "Can I have two tickets, please?" I didn't realize at the time that the only reason I got two tickets was the person in front of me had just returned two. And everybody else in the theater had had to book and get their tickets a year in advance. But I didn't know that. And so off we go, watch the first act. And at the interval, I'm saying to everybody, "Listen, hey, isn't that guy great? He's really good. I mean, he's almost as good as Nureyev." Well, of course, it was Nureyev. So I spoke to him, told him this story, and he said, "If you ask me what my ballet highlight was, the pinnacle of my career was dancing Giselle at Covent Garden, and I had been fortunate enough to go and see him." So, I told him the story I've just told you, and he said that makes it really quite equal, because you've watched me work, and now I'm watching you work. And that's when he set up for the landing into London.
Great story. Great story.
Of course, we've also carried lots of other celebrities, including golfers. And I remember one particular occasion, we carried Tom Watson, the famous US golfer. And he had been through a purple patch. He was playing really well in the early 80s. He'd won the Open, the British Open. He won the Open three times in 1980, 1982, and 1983. And he was in position to win in 1984. In 1983, I'd been lucky enough to fly on one of our special flights that took the golfers from the Open back to the USA. So the Open finished on the 17th of July, and on the 18th, we took passengers back to the States from Manchester, because the Open had been at Royal Birkdale, which is not far from Manchester. So we took off from Manchester, flew across to New York, where we landed an hour and three quarters in local time before we took off. So we took off at 9 a.m. from Manchester and landed at just gone 7:15 in the morning in New York, and everybody had gained just under 2 hours, which Concorde did every time it flew the Atlantic. But on the way over, we invited people up to the flight deck, one of whom was Tom Watson, who was absolutely delightful. And he came up armed with the Open trophy because he'd won. And so we had lots and lots of photographs taken of the Open trophy. And then the stewardess came up and said, "Mr. Watson, your lunch is ready. Are you coming back?" He said, "Yeah, I'll go back and have lunch with you." And he said, "But I'll leave the trophy here for them to take more photographs." So he left the trophy on the flight deck so we could get more photographs. And I picked it up and was smiling and just about to pass it to one of my colleagues, and I dropped it. But it landed on the center console where all of the various radios are and some very tough buttons and switches, and it dented the Open trophy. And about 20 years later, I got an opportunity to look at it closely, and that dent's still there. And funnily enough, the following year, Tom Watson was on board again flying back from the Open. This time they played at St. Andrews. So they were flying back from Prestwick to New York. And they did that crossing in just 3 hours, because Prestwick's on the West Coast and straight out to sea. That year, Famously, Tom Watson was right in prime position to win as he went up the 17th hole and to do an amazing feat of winning the Open 3 years running. But unfortunately, he pushed his ball beyond the green on the 17th and took another few to get down and scored a bogey at the same time as Seve Ballesteros was doing the birdie on the 18th to win. So Tom Watson came back with us, having finished second. And it was one of the highlights of my career because I never thought this would happen. Two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic, the stewardess came up and said, "Mike," she said, "I've got a message from Tom Watson. Can he come up and see you?" I said, "Yeah, sure, of course he can." So he came up and walked into the flight and said, "Hi, Mike, how are you?" So we had a quick chat. And he said, "Look, I really wanted to come up and see you again because you were very kind enough to invite me up last year." And he said, I've seen all the technical stuff. What I really want is, will you sign my certificate? Because last year when I flew with you, I forgot to ask you." I said, "Yeah, of course I will." And I thought, you know, maybe I've actually arrived when Tom Watson's asking me for my autograph. Yeah, there were some great times. Absolutely fantastic.
And did he ever notice the dent in his trophy?
If he did, he's too much of a gentleman to mention.
Well, you could just sign the dent, you know.
That was a small dent, not a big dent. That's a small dent.
This is a dent from the Concorde flight deck at 59,000 feet. All right, sir. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, Tom. Great pleasure. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Pan Am was a pioneer in air travel and still stands as one of the most iconic and innovative airlines in aviation history. That legacy lives on at the Pan Am Museum in Garden City, New York, where you can explore the rich history of the aircrafts and individuals at the heart of the company known as the world's most experienced airline. For more information about the Pan Am Museum, check out our website at www.thepanammuseum.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. As was once a tagline in one of our commercials, we would greatly appreciate your support to help the Pan Am Museum continue making the going great. You can also support the museum by shopping on our online store for all things Pan Am, accessories, apparel, jewelry, books, models, and posters. We want to hear from you. If you have a question for us or want to share your story, our email address is podcast@thepanammuseum.org. We are going to close out this episode with a special 2017 tribute from British Airways to celebrate their aviation heritage with a song composed by Helen Jane Long called The Aviators. As flight crews once said to passengers departing for their destinations around the world, "Thank you for flying, Pan Am."
Those first young men, the pioneers, the aviators, building superhighways in an unknown sky, leaving wives and children in their snug homes with just a kiss and a promise to return. Roaring into the clouds to battle wind and stars. Their safety systems built of brain and heart. They landed where there were no lights, transforming strange names from tall tales into pictures on postcards home. And those next young men, traveling further, faster, higher than any in history. And the ones who followed them, who skinned the edge of space, the edge of heaven, the edge of dreams. Serve.